We are going to be interviewing Todd Gordon about understanding Canada as imperialist and how to deal with that in terms of social movements. All right. Hi, Todd. Are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you're an activist and author based out of Toronto, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you're the author of Imperialist Canada and Cops, Crime, and Capitalism. Do you work with any, what activist groups do you work with?
Well, that's changed over the years, but I have been involved at different points with the Canadian Union of Public Employees, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, Mobilization for Global Justice, the Latin American and Caribbean Solidarity Network in Toronto, and its Honduras Solidarity Working Group. So those would be some of the key ones that I've been involved with.
Excellent. So I'm going to jump right into the meaty questions here.
Sure.
So what is imperialism today?
Well, I think that some people might suggest that we don't have imperialism or that imperialism doesn't exist today because we no longer see the direct territorial conquest of foreign countries by major core capitalist countries. And, of course, we know that you do actually see some of that still, Israel and Palestine, Canada and First Nations, the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. But it is true that we don't see that to the extent that we did, say, 100 years ago with the British Empire and other European colonial powers. But I think it's a real mistake to assume simply because you don't see territorial conquest, you don't see imperialism. And I think you can sort of understand imperialism as a structural or systemic relationship of power and domination between the global north and the global south, between the first world and the third world, whereby the first world, countries individually or acting collectively, are able to drain the wealth and resources in the form of labor, natural resources, and so on, from those third world countries to the global north for the profit of those corporations. And I think historically, direct territorial conquest was a part of that strategy, but today you don't need to have that kind of direct territorial conquest as much anymore because you have the more advanced global capitalist market relations in which third world countries are ensnared, and that creates a sort of really unequal relationship via the market.
Okay.
And so I think that's the way in which those wealth and resources are being drained. So I still think you have those systemic power relations that you could call quite fairly imperialism.
So how does Canada fit into this global order?
Well, Canada fits in a fairly important ways, I think. Typically, people who write about or talk about imperialism focus on countries like the United States and, to some degree, more recently, a country like China as a contending superpower. So people tend to either explicitly or implicitly conflate imperialism with superpowers. And, of course, the United States is the hegemonic power. We know that it has a great deal of power to reshape other countries in ways that benefit the United States. But that doesn't negate the fact that a country like Canada, which is obviously nowhere near the size of the United States, still participates in and benefits from that relationship of power and domination between first world and third world. Canada is a member of the core capitalist nations. It's part of the global north. It's one of the largest countries in the world, even though our population is only 34.5 million people. It's one of the largest economies in the world, I should say. And it has a lot of large multinational corporations that are really pushing beyond the borders of Canada and into the global south to gain access to the cheap labor and the resources of global south countries.
So when I was reading through your book, I guess the I consider myself a pretty informed person, but I had no clue about Export Development Canada and the way that CETA as well fit into Canadian practices of imperialism. So maybe you could detail just a little bit of that for the listener.
Well, CETA, the Canadian International Development Agency, is the Canadian government's official overseas development agency. It's the state agency that spends money for aid in Global South countries. And so the assumption is, by a lot of people, quite uncritically, is that it does good things. That it is at the very least, it's a benign presence on the world stage, or even more so, it's clear mandate is to aid and support the development of third world countries in a unselfish and altruistic way. But the reality is quite different than that. CETA operates in a way not that dissimilar to U.S. aid, the U.S. Overseas Development Agency, which has been linked to dictatorships historically, funding political organizations that are sympathetic to American interests, imposing things like structural adjustment, that is like really aggressive neoliberal policies, privatization, cutbacks, so on third world countries. And CETA, in fact, does actually quite similar things. It doesn't do it on the scale of USAID because Canada and CETA, by extension, simply doesn't have the resources of the United States or USAID. But nevertheless, it uses its resources to do those things. Not everything CETA does is like that. It does have some good projects that it engages in. But much of what CETA does is designed to facilitate the expansion of Canadian capitalism. And you can read through CETA documents, and in some ways they're actually quite clear about that. Some of the language has changed over the years. So, for example, CETA has been supporting structural adjustment policies in third world countries since the 80s. They don't use structural adjustment as a term anymore. They'll use other euphemisms for that, but that is still what they do. But CETA will actually say that one of its goals is to support the expansion of Canadian businesses, and they'll couch it in language that suggests that these things are good for third world countries, that Canadian investment is good for people in the global south, that Canadian mining companies are good for people in the global south because they bring jobs, they create development, they will raise people's standard of living. But the literature on this is pretty clear that the kinds of things that CETA funding, the imposing of market relations, aggressive free market relations on people in the global south, isn't necessarily very good for people of the global south. And in fact, you can't actually make the case that it's made people's lives better. The same goes with mining investment. So CETA is very much involved in that. And so instead of simply giving aid money for the benefit of global south people, one of its key focuses is to make these places more pliable for Canadian companies. And they do that by attaching conditions to Canadian aid. You want to get more Canadian aid? Well, then you have to prove to us that you are reliable, that you're trustworthy, that you are, in a sense, as a country or as a government, mature enough to take Canadian aid and use it responsibly. And how do you prove that you can use Canadian aid responsibly? Well, you do that by cutting back government spending. You do that by keeping wages down. You do that by creating what CETA will call, or Foreign Affairs will call, transparency. That is to say, you create good policies that will help Canadian businesses. And so that is actually at the forefront of what CETA does. And you can put aside for a moment the fact that the amount of aid that Canada spends is actually quite low, both in absolute terms, anywhere from $4 to $5 billion a year, but relatively speaking as a percentage of the size of the Canadian economy or compared to what other donor countries spend. So in the first instance, Canada's not spending very much in aid, but then when it does spend it on aid, a lot of it goes to helping Canadian businesses. I should add to this, one of the things that CETA does as well is, or has been doing, has been funding right-wing organizations in certain countries whose interests are aligned with Canadian interests and who are opposed to their local governments. So, for example, CETA has helped fund, in the past, right-wing organizations in Venezuela that participated in or supported the failed coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002, just as a for instance. And there's probably other examples we could think of, but that's one of the things that CETA does. So aid and altruism, I think we need to take a more skeptical approach. Export Development Canada is an arm's-length crown corporation that finances Canadian trade and investment with third world countries. And that includes financing mining projects and dam building projects and other such projects that are often not wanted by local communities in third world countries where they're taking place. And it funds these projects without proper advanced research or consultation with people in the third world where these investments are taking place.
How much of Canadian aid would you estimate actually goes to human development projects versus industrial and capitalist development projects? Like, what's the ratios?
Well, I can't give you a precise ratio, but I would say easily less than half. One thing to note, there are international aid NGOs or international NGOs that monitor aid spending who will also point out that for most donor countries, half of the money that they budget for aid actually goes to their own local bureaucracy. So we'll put that aside for a moment as well. But the money that actually does get spent, I would say it's less than half, actually. I'll just give you a for instance that I think kind of paints a fairly clear picture. The most recent big announcement from CETA, which you and your listeners may be familiar with, is their new partnership programs. It's a pilot project where CETA will be spending over the next 5 years over $20 million on partnership funding with big mining companies for what they call development and corporate social responsibility projects in third world countries. And so some of this will go to helping to build schools or medical clinics, which those things are important, those things are needed. But the reality is that the amount that corporations are spending and that is being spent, in fact, by CETA is a pittance compared to what those corporations will receive in profits from their mining projects over the course of these mines operating. And so what CETA is doing, really, is trying to buy off local communities by saying, if you accept this mine and you don't oppose this mine and you don't make trouble for it, here's some money from us, as well as the mining companies and a few NGOs who are on board with us, and we'll give you some money for some schools and some medicines and so on. It won't be anything like you would get if these companies were taxed properly by your governments in the third world, but we'll give you some money. So it's kind of like a hush money. An activist in Peru recently called it a pacification program. So that's just a for instance, and that's a new project that CETA has been pushing for, and I think you're going to see down the road a lot more of that. But for reasons like that, and other reasons, like the new CETA Country of Focus program, well, it's not new, it's a few years old now, whereby CETA is concentrating its aid money on 20 countries, I would suggest to you that for these reasons, you're seeing easily less than 50% of its spending on real humanitarian projects. So the Country of Focus program, for instance, under Stephen Harper, has taken aid away from Africa and from the poorest countries in Africa, not completely away from Africa, but from some of the poorest countries in Africa, and then concentrated that aid on countries in Africa and Latin America. And so countries in Africa that get targeted for more concentrated aid from Canada tend to be countries where Canada has either a large mining presence or where they're looking to build up that mining presence and create the conditions where Canadian companies can come in and explore and develop mines. In Latin America and the Caribbean, there's five recipients who are part of the Country of Focus program. Of those five countries, two have seen coups that have been directly or indirectly supported by Canada, Haiti and Honduras. Three now have signed trade agreements subsequent to the creation of the Country of Focus program: Colombia, Peru, and Honduras. So those, I think, are really good examples of how Canadian aid is tied to business interests and not humanitarian relief.
Most definitely. I noted that another fact that I found in your book that I did not know was that actually the size and global leadership position of Canada's mining industry, if we're talking about, if instead we didn't focus on a state's capacity only to wage, but the relationship between a state and its industry's capacity to have its clutches around different places of the world, Canada's mining industry is actually a global leader, you could say, in imperialism.
Oh, for sure. The Canadian mining industry represents about, and it, you know, changes from year to year, but usually on average, close to 2/3 of all the mining companies in the world are Canadian companies. And that includes the largest companies in the world and the smaller companies. So Canada has some of the largest mining companies in the world. Barrick Gold might be the most infamous. But it also leads in exploration companies. And that's important because in the case of mining, some of the exploration companies are actually far worse than the larger companies that come in and get more attention. Because the smaller companies, they don't have the kind of money to buy off local communities with corporate social responsibility projects. They don't have the resources to buy off communities, so they will go in and they will push their way in, and they will do the initial exploration, usually against the will of local communities. And it's after that exploration is done that the larger companies will come in and partner with those smaller companies to build the mine or buy out those smaller companies. So some of the smaller companies actually have worse track records in terms of their relationship with local communities than do the larger companies. So it's very true that Canadian mining companies are the biggest, the most powerful in the world, collectively speaking, and do the most damage in the world. The Mining Association of Canada actually had a report written that it tried to bury about a year and a half ago, maybe it was 2 years ago. And basically what they did was they commissioned this study to look at what countries' companies were most involved in environmental and human rights problems. And what the study found was that far and away it's Canadian companies. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was far and away Canadian companies that are the most implicated in human rights and environmental disasters without a close competitor. The Mining Association of Canada tried to then keep that study quiet. They didn't mention it or anything like that, and then it got leaked and it came out and so on. So we know that Canadian companies, according to the Canadian mining industry itself, are the worst in the world. So they're the most in the world and they're the worst in the world.
Okay.
But if I could add just one thing to that,
actually,
it's very important.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
Well, I would just add one thing to that, because we can look at mining companies and what they're doing, but we should also look at who's financing these Canadian mining companies. And right there, we can see the connection between Canadian mining capital and Canadian banking capital, because the most important stock exchange in the world for raising investment money for Canadian companies or mining companies in general is the Toronto Stock Exchange. And Canadian banks are implicated in this. They are some of the most important investors. So, for example, just recently, Scotiabank bought out the Royal Bank of Scotland in Colombia, and it said explicitly the reason it did that was so it would get a key piece of the growing mining and oil and gas pie in Colombia now that Canada and the United States have free trade agreements with Colombia.
That's really interesting. I just want to quickly switch gears and finish up the what the problem is portion of this interview.
Sure.
And I was wondering if you could quickly detail some of the way the Canadian government supports these practices, specifically in either Haiti or Honduras, whichever one you want to pick, what it's done with the state forces to support these types of practices.
Sure. And we don't have a lot of time here, and we could spend a lot more time talking about the way in which it does this, but I'll just very quickly, I think the Canadian government has a few different ways in which it supports Canadian companies. And we just talked about CETA, for example, or Export Development Canada. But we could also look at embassies, for example. Embassies in countries like Haiti or Honduras play key roles in supporting their companies, in facilitating meetings between mining and other corporate executives, maquila companies, and so on, between leaders of those companies and local politicians to push for laws or policies that are beneficial to Canadian companies. This is a regular thing. It's widely known within countries that have large deposits, financial resources, that the Canadian embassies are basically partners with Canadian mining companies. So that's widely known. But in cases like Haiti, where there was a coup in 2004 against the democratically elected government, the Canadian government in foreign affairs and CETA actually worked diplomatically for at least a year to 2 years prior to the coup with the United States and France to help undermine that government. It did it through diplomatic interventions, through withdrawing aid to the poorest country in the hemisphere, one of the poorest in the world, and then rechanneling those aid dollars to basically government opposition groups and so on, who then proceeded to destabilize the Haitian government. And when that government became destabilized and paramilitary forces in Haiti who had been tied to previous dictatorships started to move on the capital, then Canadian forces came in and participated in the physical removal of the president, the democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And so you saw special forces operating in Haiti at the time. And after the president was removed from power, you then saw regular military forces from Canada participate in pacification programs in the slums in the capital or around the capital in Haiti, Port-au-Prince, that were strong supporters or strongholds of support for the deposed president. So basically, Haiti gives you a good sort of crystallizes it, where you see the diplomatic strategy through the embassy, through foreign affairs, you see CETA aid funding to destabilize the government, and then you see the military come in. And that's one particular more egregious example, but you can see it in more piecemeal ways in various countries around the Third World, Africa and Latin America most specifically, where you see the embassy play a key role in helping to finance and get meetings with local leaders and push for more sympathetic mining and other kinds of laws.
So for the sake of argument, we're going to take for granted that there is another way of doing business. and I'm going to ask, could you detail maybe quickly, because I want to focus on the Canadian in Canada context, so the domestic context, but quickly say, just paint a picture quickly of some of the resistance going on in country to these practices, like in the colonized countries going on.
Sure. And the reality is, even though in Canada we're probably lagging in important ways in terms of both our consciousness of what Canada is and represents on the world stage and in terms of our concrete organizing. But in certain third world countries, certain global south countries, they're not. There are people who are mobilizing and doing very important grassroots work against specifically Canadian companies or Canadian-supported policies. And so, for example, most recently in Ecuador, we've seen a mass march of people for water and for life from indigenous communities against mining. And Canada is the largest mining investor in Ecuador. Recently, you've seen mass marches in Peru, again, often under the banner of for water and for life, against mining, and Canada is one of the largest mining countries in Peru. You're seeing or have seen in countries like Ecuador and Peru as well, physical blockades. You've seen this in Argentina as well against a Canadian mining company, where local communities, often quite poor communities, often indigenous communities, will actually physically block roadways to keep trucks bringing equipment for the mines to operate from proceeding to the mine itself. So you've actually seen physical stoppages against mines from sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of people. So you've seen that in Argentina, Ecuador, Peru. In Honduras, you've seen communities mobilize around Canadian mining, trying to raise awareness. That has involved blockades as well in Guatemala. So you're seeing there are lots of examples out there of people actually taking physical action and direct action to stop Canadian companies. And there are other examples from different parts of the world that we could speak more to, but I think those provide a good glimpse of what's going on.
Now, I'm going to ask you a strategic question for the domestic context. I noticed more often that the way that social movements here are addressing these issues are often they're choosing, like there's protest Barrick Gold, or there's trying to illuminate for the public specific companies or ties to a certain project that are bad. Is that an effective way of organizing, or are there certain wider strategies that you think need to be utilized to take on the pattern of behavior? Or do we need to focus on individual cases at this point for addressing wider Canadian imperial practices rather than, say, the Protest Barrick Gold specifically campaign?
Well, if you'll permit me, I'm going to take a bit of an easy way out in response to your question, because it's a good question. It's an important question. And my sort of superficial response would be, I think we need both. And you might find that unsatisfactory, but I think in some ways it's you might find that an easy way out. But I think in important ways it's true that we do need both. And I'll preface my comments just by saying that, as I said earlier, we really do lag behind in Canada. There are people doing some very important work, but in general, the left lags behind the times in terms of what Canada is doing on the world stage and our consciousness of it and how the left is organizing or in fact, really not organizing around these things. So the first thing I would just note is I think that this organizing is still early, and I think we've got a lot of learning to do and a lot of figuring out to do in terms of building a movement or movements against Canadian imperialism. And I think it's going to take some time to figure it out. And clearly we have a lot of work to do in terms of raising awareness and raising consciousness of what's going on, of what Canada is actually doing on a world stage and what Canada represents. It's not some benign liberal country who either is just neutral or plays a positive role on the world stage. It's an imperialist country, not a superpower, but an imperialist country. And we have a long way to go in terms of raising people's consciousness specifically around that. But in terms of the organizing, I think in some ways the organizers is going to reflect that. So to the extent that there's a really limited consciousness out there around what Canada is doing on the world stage, it's going to be hard to try and build a kind of broader consciousness and a broader movement around Canada's imperialist, as you were pointing out. That is needed for sure, but I think we may still have a step to go too. And I'm not saying we shouldn't shirk from raising the point that Canada is an imperialist in the organizing that we do. But nevertheless, I think that some of the more specific organizing is important. And I think it has helped raise some awareness amongst a broader layer of people, even though we have a long way to go. And I think that the more that we organize around specific companies, and it's true, it's easier to organize around specific companies. It's Barrick Gold and its security forces killing half a dozen to a dozen people in Tanzania is a far more concrete thing to organize around than a more abstract thing like Canadian imperialism. But I do think that those things are they're interconnected, they're related, that the more you can organize around specific things, whether it's Barrick Gold or Canada's free trade agreement with the human rights troubled Honduras, or the mining company Goldcorp's buying up of programs at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, the more we organize against some of the specific things, the more we create space, I hope, to raise the broader questions that you pointed out that need raising. So I'd like to think that it's not one or the other, but objectively speaking, it's a little bit harder to raise it more broadly now because we still have a lot of work to do. But I don't know if that's too easy of an answer.
What do you think the main challenge or barrier is that we're facing from making those steps to up the campaigns?
That's a tough one. I guess one thing that comes to mind immediately is some of the vestiges of of left nationalism that certainly goes back to the new left of the 1960s and 70s. And in fact, you can trace it back even further than that. But clearly, it was very prominent in the new left of the 60s and 70s. This idea that Canada is potentially, as Canada, a much more progressive space than, say, for example, the United States. And some people went so far as to even argue that Canada was more or less a colony of the United States, and so that a fight for an independent Canada was, by definition, then a progressive fight, and that's what we should be focusing on, is greater independence for Canada. And a lot of people would argue that that Canadian companies were being taken over, or as the language today, being hollowed out by American companies and so on, and that we should be defending Canadian industry and Canadian jobs. And so I think, of course, we should be defending Canadian jobs and good-paying jobs, but it conflates something. It conflates the interests of capital with the interests of workers, the interests of corporations with the interests of labor. And those are two very distinct things as far as I'm concerned. And I think it is a very, very misleading to suggest that Canada is either colonized or dependent on the United States, that Canadian corporations or Canadian capitalists don't have agency, or that they don't have objective interests outside of Canada in the third world, that they are, in fact, imperialist. I think that's a really, really wrong and mistaken position. I think it was wrong in the 1960s and 70s, and I think it's wrong today. But it still has a lot of residual effects on people on the left, including some people who would see themselves as anti-capitalist, but certainly on people in the more social democratic left, and clearly you can see that in the NDP, this idea that we should be protecting Canadian industry without any kind of critical analysis about what is Canadian industry and what it does in the world. Is it better if a mining company is Canadian versus Brazilian or Swiss or American? I don't think so. A Canadian company is just as likely to exploit its workers and the environment as any other country's company. So I think that that is a big thing that we need to fight against, that sort of residual left nationalism, this idea that Canada, just because it's smaller and doesn't have the kind of power and influence the United States does, is by definition better. It's not.
Yeah.
I think it's not a question of qualitative difference from American imperialism. It's a question of quantitative. And I think that's a real challenge that we face in trying to build awareness to that, to what Canada is doing on the world stage.
As the concluding question, I wanted to ask you, just for people looking to take up organizing against Canadian imperialism abroad, how would you recommend they connect it to imperialism at home in their organizing?
Well, I guess there's some concrete ways that they could do that. One of the things that I thought was important for my book was to show that Canadian imperialism abroad is not independent from what I would call imperialism at home, or you might say colonialism at home with respect to Indigenous or First Nation communities, that there's a long historical legacy of that racist imperialism towards First Nations within Canadian borders that precedes and shapes or forms, I think, the imperialism abroad that we see increasingly today. And so Canadian capitalism, in a more abstract way, Canadian capitalism got its start in Canada. It got its start by dispossessing Indigenous peoples of their land and their resources, of trying to destroy Indigenous cultures and force Indigenous peoples into the wage labor force. And that process was central to creating a more stable foundation for Canadian companies to survive and to thrive in capitalist marketplace. Canadian capitalism could not have existed and could not have prospered without the dispossession of Indigenous peoples. That, to me, is a basic fact of Canadian capitalism, of the existence of the Canadian state. Those two things are inseparable. But more concretely, you could even point to specific companies that got their start in Canada through investments that have been very negative for First Nation communities, and who, after building up their successes in Canada, have then been able to move internationally into the third world with greater power and resources to exploit Indigenous or poor peasant communities in the third world. So Barrick Gold has mining interests in Canada. Goldcorp has mining interests in Canada. Look at the oil companies in Canada who got their start in the tar sands, which obviously we know are an environmental catastrophe, but are also based on stolen, unceded First Nation land, and who are now, those oil companies are now investing in or trying to find investments in countries like Colombia, for instance, which will be extremely destructive for Indigenous peoples in Colombia, or Canadian dam building firms and so on, who built up their power through damming and degrading Indigenous environments and or ecologies, and are now moving beyond Canadian borders. So I think there's very concrete ways we can do that, and it does mean people need some familiarity with Canadian companies and what they're doing. But it's not hard to find; the information is out there.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, and I really appreciated this interview. And we'll probably ask you to come back to continue telling some stories.
Great. Thank you for having me, and I'd be more than happy to come back.
All right. Awesome. Take care.